Thanks for tuning in. You're about to listen to a conversation between author Tim Ayliffe and Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival's artistic director, Catherine Duplumonage. So they're going to be discussing Tim's latest crime thriller, the fifth edition to the John Bailey series, The Wrong Man, which was recently released. This recording was made at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts in the Henry Carmichael Theatre, which is located on Gadigal land.
Welcome, everyone. It's lovely to be here again. I recognise a few familiar faces. And on your seats, or next to your seats, you'll see a Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival bookmark. The festival is in November, and Tim will be there, but I'll tell you more about what he's doing later. So let's focus on Tim now, the man of the moment. I really wanted to talk to you about all your books, as well as focusing on The Wrong Man. Because as Soap said, you've got five books. I've got them all here except one. I must have lent it out. Always a bad thing to do with a good book, because you never get it back. So you started with The Greater Good, State of Fear, The Enemy Within, Killer, Traitor, Spy, and now The Wrong Man. Great titles, and I'll talk a bit about titles later, because I love to know how people work out titles. It's always exciting. As Sophie said, your books are about, they're about espionage, they're about extremism, they're about politics, they're about global power plays, but also national power plays. Now, that may sound incredibly like hard work to read, but it isn't, because they're not, it's not reading a treatise, it's reading an exciting story which brings to life what you've been hearing on the news, what you've been reading in the papers, what you've been hearing on the radio. So, and it's all with a really good storyline and very relatable characters. Some that I don't like as much, but we can talk about them later, you know, but they're good too. So your background in journalism obviously has informed all your books.
Yeah, it has. And I guess importantly, all of my books always begin with a crime, because even though I like to chip off a big issue with each of the books, I'm obviously trying to thoroughly entertain the reader at the same time. And I think that the crime fiction and thrillers that I loved reading as a kid and then as an adult were those that actually told me a little bit about the world as it is now. So I've tried to do that with my books. So with each book, I've chipped off a big issue. So with The Greater Good, my first book, it was about Australia caught in the middle of the US China power game, and that one was inspired by a conversation I had in the US State Department with a US official who asked me if I could ever imagine a day when Australia would turn its back on the United States in favour of a closer relationship with China. And that comment stayed with me, so that it actually helped me come up with the character of John Bailey, who's the key character, but also Ronnie Johnson, the CIA officer who appears in my books, and some of the other characters, because I thought Sydney is a global city. Australia is a very different country than it was 10 or 20, 30, 40 years ago. We are actually a consequential country. Yeah. We are a very important ally of the United States because we're living in the China century.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of came up with the idea of Bailey and then the books, and then from then on, it was actually, okay, what issue am I going to have a look at in the next book? And so the second book, State of Fear, was about Islamist-inspired terrorism. The third book was about abuse of power and also neo-Nazis and the rise of the far-right nationalism that we've seen sort of washing, you know, like a wave through the world. And then the fourth book, Killer, Traitor, Spy, was about Russian spies in Australia, and there's a Chinese link there as well, but we've seen these stories, you know, in the news over the last few years, and that book, I'd seen some comments. I read the annual threat assessment speeches that Mike Burgess always gives every year, because it gives you an insight into where the intelligence services are focusing their energy. And he made a comment. He said that there are more foreign spies or their proxies operating in Australia than at the height of the Cold War.
I remember hearing that and thinking,
yeah. So then that was another launch point for a plot idea for me. And then, of course, this book, it's probably my closest to a straight crime novel. Yes, there's some big picture global stuff in there, but this one is about violent misogyny. It is such a big issue, not only in Australia but around the world at the moment, that I really wanted to look at it as a in the crime novel, but from all different levels. So looking at it from experience in workplace to social media to the extreme end of it, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more.
Yeah. And, I mean, when you said that all your books start with the crime, that's what makes it not what's in the newspapers. It involves us. Immediately you're pulled in and then the background, the threads become apparent, but we're always involved.
Yeah, I like to say in my books, everything in them either has happened, will happen, or could happen. If you've heard me speak before, you've heard me say that, because I say it all the time. But it is the general rule in which I write by. And then the other general rule is that every chapter, every page needs to fight for themselves in my books. So if I have a chapter that is not advancing the plot in some way, which is either the plot or character, setting, all of that, if I can't explain exactly what it's doing there, it goes.
Has to go.
I want a pacey book. I want to entertain the reader, but it's got to be true to that idea of this could really happen, or has something like this happened?
Kind of worrying thought, actually, when you read the books. I mean, some of it is really disturbing. But we'll go a bit more into that later. It's never depressing, which I think is what's important. You know, the good guys kind of win. They never might not win long term, but then there'd be no story.
Well, and I guess that talks to my outlook on life as well. Like, I'm overly, you know, an optimistic person. I do believe in the fundamental good in people and in the world. So there's always hope.
And that happens on different levels in the books, and we'll talk a bit about that as well. But so you grew up as a journalist. I mean, you were a journalist for a long time. But radio and television, did you work in print as well?
I started in print, actually. So when I was thinking about what I wanted to do for a living going through school, a lot of conversations with particularly my father about that, and I was really interested in the world and telling stories. And my great uncle was a former war reporter called Terry Southwell Keeley, who was, you know, had a bullet in his typewriter. And these stories, you know, about him stayed with me. And I knew him only so well because he died when I was quite young. But I was always interested in journalism. And then I also thought journalism is not a bad ticket into writing books either, because I was always so interested in the world that I wanted to write, but I always wanted to be a novelist from when I was a kid.
Really?
And it was just always in me. So it was just working out the path to that. I mean, I wrote a book in my early 20s that's crap and none of you will ever see it. And another one I wrote about a third of in my late 20s my day job was too busy and we started having kids, my wife and I, and I gave it up for a bit and then started again in my early 30s. So I always wanted to do it. And my journalism career, coming back to your question, going through university, played a lot of rugby and I ended up writing a column for Glebe and Inner Western Weekly about Sydney Uni rugby each week.
Okay.
So I'd cover the grade right down to Colts. And I did it for free, for nothing. It just helped me build a portfolio and I love doing that. And so I did that for a couple of the years that I was playing rugby at Sydney Uni. I also started working for a magazine on the Northern Beaches of Sydney, which is a paid gig for Pittwater Life, and that was run by two former Fleet Street journalists, Pam Fox and Mike Southern, and they taught me a lot about the fundamentals of journalism.
Mm.
So I was writing articles for them. Doing any other job they wanted. I'd be writing, you know, doing the checks for people had to get paid and whatever, delivering magazines as well. And then when I finished university, I did a double degree. English and history, sorry. So that was an arts degree. And then I did journalism. And then I thought, all right, I've got this portfolio of work behind me. I'm going to London. So I bought a one-way ticket for London and thought, well, that's the sort of media capital of the world. I'll just have a crack there. And mum and dad are looking at me going, okay, go, son. But I had a visa to work for 6 months. So I went and luckily, long story, got rejected everywhere. And Sky News UK gave me some shifts as a script runner, which is literally the lowest job there at their 24-hour news channel. And then because I'd had this portfolio of work, they started giving me a bit more like sub-editing on their website. And it was we're talking very early 2000s here, so it's the start of online journalism and digital journalism. So I started getting quite a bit of work there, and then suddenly the boss came to me one day and he said, mate, I've just had this email from HR department saying you can't work here after next month. He said, well, do you want to stay? I said, yeah. And he said, well, how about we sponsor you? So they sponsored me to stay.
Your optimism pays off.
Yeah, no, look, I took a chance and believe in yourself and that's all you can do. So I ended up working there for 4 years and then came back to the ABC 2006. And the ABC at the time, we'll come back to the books in a minute, but I always find interesting talking about this story because the ABC was so far behind the eight ball in terms of...
On digital,
24-hour news... Did not know how to do news now. Knew how to do good journalism, but not news now. So I was 26 and then suddenly thrust into...
You were doing it.
..that world and then setting it up. I mean, a guy called Gavin Morris, who was news director at the ABC for many years, he was a good friend of mine but also a mentor and he was leading the charge in many ways with Kate Tourne, the then director on that, and I became a key lieutenant, if you like, of his. And then until I sort of then rose up and ended up running TV news before I left.
And obviously in that TV news, that's the world that you were in, that international world of that you write about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was your bread and butter.
I was very fortunate. I ended up having 17 years at the ABC and I loved it. I mean, the ABC doesn't always get it right. You know, the ABC gets – people love it, they hate it, but everyone watches it and reads it. And public broadcasting, in my view,
I'm a great radio person.
Incredibly important. You look at the fractured media at the moment. You look at the really, I guess, non-partisan media out there as well. Partisan media, I should say. That I think it's really important, and I'll continue to be a champion for it, knowing that mistakes will be made along the way. But I couldn't imagine a media landscape here without it. And you only need to look at the divisive world of the United States
the US,
at the moment, and how there is really no one there to hold power to account in the way that a strong public broadcaster can. You look at the BBC,
there's no one that you actually trust. You know that you're going to X to find out this angle, Y to find out that angle. Absolutely. So tell us about the freedom to write fiction as opposed to being in journalism. I mean, is it a liberation?
Yeah. For me, my day jobs in the end got so busy at the ABC, the only time I could write was 5 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday. And I used to just steal a few hours. I mean, the problem for me, it was a good problem to have, but my first book took me about almost 4 years from starting writing it to getting published. And then I got offered a 3-book deal. So then I was like, oh, my God, how am I going to do this? And my wife's looking at me going, yes, how are you going to do this? So I then had to just fit it around, like work without interrupting my day job, which was really busy. So the weekends when I used to do it, and I'd spend the week, thinking about it, and then I'd just do between 2 and 5 hours on Saturdays and Sundays. And for me, it was like catching up with old friends, and I loved it. And I tell you what else was great about it. It's quite liberating to be able to explore some of those issues in a different way. And it actually allows you to put so much truth in your fiction that actually sometimes is hard to put in, for instance, a report, or because the rules of journalism, the rules of good journalism, as they should be, are really, really strong. You need all those sources. You need people on the record. You need all of that.
Yeah. You need to be able to justify everything you say or write or broadcast.
That's right. But then there are still things in which you know to be true.
But you can't necessarily prove.
That's right. So for me, in my books, I could play around with some of those ideas and explore them In the world of fiction, in a way, I couldn't.
Yeah, so it's like you could do, you could take places, things where you want, to the places you want to, rather than the places, or having to stop because you have to, because you can't prove it, you can't.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Yeah. And then, look, there are some conversations as well that might just spark ideas as well. Look, I think with The Wrong Man, I look at incels, which are involuntary celibate men. So many of you would have heard about this. It's extreme end of misogynist violence and radicalism.
Mm.
And I was able to, with this book, I think explore that issue and give you an understanding of who incels are, how people become incels in a better way than actually I could have...
if you'd been writing a factual piece.
In a news report.
Yeah. So what's most useful about your background in journalism when it comes to your books?
Look, asking... I think knowing the questions that need to be asked to get to the answers. So what I mean by that is if I'm going to, like, show, like, explore an issue, it's trying to, like, show people what that looks like.
Mm.
So for me, I don't write really, really heavy on detail. These are not non-fiction books where I've got a bibliography, you know, or I've got, you know, footnotes for every page that's going to justify the points I'm making. I want to give readers an understanding through the showing.
Yeah, so, absolutely. So that show, don't tell thing, which is one of the first things you learn when you try to write, is really important, because you end up feeling beaten over the head if somebody's trying to say, look, you know, this is very important. Well, show me.
So
show me the impact. Show me what happens.
And I guess the neatest answer, the way I can answer that question as well, is that I think really good crime fiction peels back the curtain on the darkness. And for me, in my job as a journalist, I have seen a lot of darkness. And I've seen what that does to people who have reported on that as well. And so when I'm writing, I'm writing sometimes with, like, either my baggage or someone else's baggage, or actually some emotion in terms of having experienced that, whether it's in a whether it's as a journalist, or whether it's my experience, or whether it is,
you know,
delving into that issue deeply as a journalist. So it enables me to write with some kind of confidence in regards to what I'm exploring.
Well, this is a really good time to come to Bailey. So all the books, the centre of all the books is John Bailey, and he's experienced plenty of darkness. But he keeps going. So tell us a bit about him, and then maybe where he came from. He is a fabulous character.
He keeps going, but most importantly for me with these books, he keeps growing. So Bailey in the first book, we encounter a man who's broken. So he spent 2 decades just chasing the adrenaline of being in the wrong place at the right time. So
very good way of putting it.
By that, I mean wars, terrorism, all of that. So I've worked with... So I wasn't a war correspondent. I wouldn't pretend to have the experiences in which I talk about that Bailey's had. But you know, I've been to some hotspots at, you know, those times. I've been on some stories, you know, during, you know, when things like that have happened. But... really, I'm drawing on a lot of the experience of people that I've worked with, those former war correspondents particularly, who are quite damaged and they're triggered. I mean, we could be sitting in a meeting sometimes with one of them and, I might just notice them sort of shaking. Or they have real effects on people.
Real,
so
profound.
So with Bailey, and a lot of journalists... over time, like cops. So cops are similar in a way, because journalists and cops have this sort of doggedness inside them to stop bad people from doing bad things or chase the truth. And because the stakes are high in with those things in mind, they start putting that before a lot of other things. before relationships. Family, relationships,
and self.
Yeah, that's right. So the sacrifices they make are often quite selfish ones towards those that are close to them, but it gets them closer to the story. So that's the unfortunate reality of it. Sometimes these people, then they spend so much time there. So for someone like John Bailey, he spent so many years doing that. When we meet him, I was more interested in, I've got backstories littered through all of my books that help to give another layer to his character. But I was much more interested in showing the impact of that on him rather than telling the story of that. So it's, and then the impact of that on him is then him realizing the things he got wrong. And then that, I was just writing this morning in this new Bailey book I'm writing, and I started writing a bit about where he's wondering whether he should have done that or not and whether it was all worth it.
You mean his backstory.
Losing those decades without his daughter in the Middle East, leaving her back in Sydney, and the breakdown of his marriage. Like, was it all worth it? And so he's got those questions in his mind, and that's the sixth book that I'm writing. But in the first book, he's on his knees. You know, he's drinking to help him sleep. He's riddled with PTSD. But he's rekindling that relationship with his daughter. He's been forgiven by his ex-wife, and he's falling in love again. So that's where we meet him in the first book. And he's a bit hopeless and he's going to stumble, but he's growing. And so in the first book, he's a 53-year-old man. And I love writing a man at that age growing up.
It's a good way of putting it.
And I really enjoy it in all the books, because he's a thoroughly human person, and we all are.
And he continues to change, and things happen to him. It's not all sweetness and light. It's not like this nice little journey uphill, you know, getting better and better. Things happen that are difficult and that he has to deal with, without giving any spoilers.
No spoilers, but he gets bashed up a bit, really. I mean, he's always still chasing stories but he's doing it from Sydney mostly now. Because he's back here, he's done with those years reporting overseas. As a war correspondent, this is his home. Sydney's his town. He loves it, he hates it, but now there's no place he'd rather be.
Can I say, talking about bad things happening to him, I didn't intend to do this, I'll just read you the opening, if that's all right. John Bailey wasn't into boats and he didn't especially like this one. Sorry, and he especially didn't like this one. The cruiser stank of petrol and rotting fish and had a hard deck that amplified every bump in the ocean. But the boat wasn't the only thing bothering Bailey. There was the dead guy leaking blood on the deck beside him, the chains attached to Bailey's ankles and the handcuffs digging into his wrists. There was also the man sitting opposite, tossing a gun between his hands like a cricket ball. Yeah, he gets himself into some degree of trouble.
I told you it always starts with the body.
Yeah. That was very, I'm like, gosh, how's he going to get out of this one? And it goes south from there. And that's really good. Sometimes people make it unrealistic. You think, oh, come on, nobody can get out of this. But this one then, you know, it comes full circle. So I thought that worked really, really well. Did you always intend to write a series, like when you wrote the first one, or did you think that was Bailey done and dusted?
Once I was a fair way through it, and I started thinking about the next one.
Yeah.
I hadn't finished and I started thinking about the next one. And then it was writing the book. In the writing, I realised that, okay, this guy's going to live on. So I knew pretty early on. Once I came up with a character, and then he started, it's a funny way to describe it, but he started talking to me about other things while I was writing that book. And so actually, when this book was going out to market, my agent had this book and two synopses for the next two. And that's why I think I signed the three-book deal. Mm. But it just sort of was clear to my publisher that, you know, this guy's in it for the long haul.
He's going to be around, both you and him.
Yeah.
So this isn't a series in the sense that, you know, book one takes you to here, then you follow the story to book two. Yes, there is a continuing story. But do you reckon it's fine to read them out of order? Because I do.
Oh, absolutely. And it's important that people know that. I mean, all of my books are written to be read as standalones. So if the latest book, and I always say I'd probably start with the latest book, to be honest. There's enough context in there or little flashbacks and things that help to explain the characters and who they are and how they're connected. So absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, maybe read that one first, then go back to the first, and then anyway, yeah, because you're exploring. It's like looking at something from lots of different points of view, and yeah, the story. There's a story in each one, but there's also the central character, but other people too. Who are some of the other people who recur?
Well, look, the fastest selling book of mine at the moment, other than the brand new one that just came out, is my first book.
Mm.
So I think that's how people discover you, and then go back. To the beginning.
Go back to the beginning and work through. It's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Tell us something about some of the other characters.
So in this book, there are two detectives really. One no longer with us, and the other one is Detective Holly Sutton. So the book begins. So that's the prologue we touched on there, which we come back to later in the book, but. The book actually begins with the murder of a socialite, an influencer type, a PR queen, if you like, of Sydney, who is murdered at Palm Beach. She's dating a millionaire property developer who's also an ex-soldier. And her body is left on a bench at this house because the killer wanted her to be found that way.
Mm.
And so it's about social media and misogynist violence. But so Holly Sutton, Detective Holly Sutton, a young detective with a gambling problem, who is the first on the scene. Is the first detective on the scene.
Mm.
So she starts investigating that murder. John Bailey comes across an old case file of his ex-girlfriend, Detective Sharon Dexter, who died. And in that case file it's about the murder of a woman outside the Sydney Club, I call it, which is a men's only membership club in Sydney, of which they still exist, particularly in Melbourne. And she was found dead in the alley outside. A serial killer is serving a life sentence for her murder, along with several others. And Bailey suddenly realises that Sharon Dexter was worried that she got the wrong man.
And she put the serial killer...
And the serial killer is in prison for women he did kill, but maybe she wasn't one of them. So Bailey, in looking at that murder, suddenly starts seeing a connection with the murder of Totty Evans up at Palm Beach.
Great name, by the way.
So then... Holly Sutton and John Bailey start their investigations. Mm. Their worlds collide, if you like, and they're chasing the same thing, looking for potentially the same perpetrator. So that gives you an understanding of those characters, really. Detective Holly Sutton is the woman who Bailey, who helped Bailey to find himself again. They'd had an on-again, off-again relationship for years. With him continuing to go back to the Middle East to cover the wars when he was doing that. And when he's at rock bottom, he sort of rekindles that relationship with her, and she's one of the real reasons that helps him to grow again, as I talked about in the books. And so Holly Sutton, in the now, in many ways, is almost a younger version of Dexter.
Mm.
And Bailey sees that in her and really admires that in her. In some ways, someone asked me this question the other day, which I'll ask myself now. There is something of a love story here as well in this book. And it's Bailey's, you know, love for the woman that he feels, you know, saved his life. So what he's trying to do in his life, what he couldn't do for her before her death.
And there's a relationship also between the police and in all the books, between the police and Bailey. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good. And that tension's really interesting as well. So he's trying to find stuff out and follow his nose, and he's determined, but that doesn't always work with what the police want to do.
Well, there's always that tension. I mean, there's a tension always between authorities and journalists in that journalists are chasing the truth, and sometimes that's uncomfortable or sometimes that's problematic for the cops who are in the middle of investigation. And if that story gets out now, it's going to be really problematic for their job, what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
So, look, Bailey's can be an annoying journalist who's always there trying to find out things before anyone else and wanting to break the story, whereas, you know, the detectives are, hang on.
let's get to the bottom of it
in
a complete way. Now, there's another character. You mentioned him earlier, the CIA bloke. Tell us about him.
Well, Ronnie Johnson, I love writing Ronnie Johnson's character, and I need him, really. Bailey needs him because he's the opposite of Bailey.
Yeah, he's a foil.
To write global thrillers set in Sydney, and as I said before, I wanted to do that because I don't think anyone else is doing it, to be honest, at the moment anyway. So I feel like I've got this space a little bit to myself. But also, Sydney is, you know,
that city.
It is an important city.
Mm.
So if I'm going to connect Sydney to the world and those global issues I've been talking about, then I need a character to help us on that journey, and that's Ronnie Johnson. So Ronnie Johnson's a CIA officer. He and Bailey go way back to the Middle East. They met on the scene of a car bombing in Beirut back in the late 80s, and that's actually the beauty with coming up with some of these one-liners in early books about something, how they met. Well, four books later, so I wrote that in The Greater Good, my first book, that's where they met. And then in Killer, Traitor, Spy, I wrote the chapter of how they met. So they're the little flashback things that I can talk about in a way to give you, peel back the layers on the story, but giving you a good understanding in all the books.
Yeah, past and present.
Yeah. So I really enjoy doing that. It's just trying to remember all the things I've written.
Do you have a method for doing that?
I don't, but at some point I may need to get a bit more formal with it. Yeah. I remember Michael Connelly once saying that he wrote about, it must have been two-thirds of a book, and turned it into his publisher, and his publisher said, "Michael, you've already written this book."
Yeah. And I mean, readers will go, "Hang on a minute. You said in another book that he doesn't like prawns or whatever it is."
Yeah, that's right. That's
and
right.
He can't stand the fish markets.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's things like that I need to remember. But look, some of Bailey's is drawn from me as well. So
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah. Well, look, it's not, as I've said, I would never pretend that I was a war correspondent. I wasn't. I worked with some great, amazing journalists who did that stuff, and I draw from their experience. But I've done enough and seen enough to put layers of some of my experience into his character. But it's sometimes, like, it's his humour, maybe it's his some of his worldview and things that are in the character that are in there. So I raise that because it's easier to remember his likes and dislikes if I also share them.
You share them. Well, that's kind of handy. Yeah, that is very handy, isn't it?
But look, on to Ronnie. I didn't answer your question properly.
So I have problems with Ronnie.
Look, I think you should have problems with Ronnie. I mean,
his ethics.
That's it. He's so Ronnie believes in America.
I was about to say America. Yeah.
So his idea is his idea of making the world safe is keeping America in power and doing anything to make that the case. So he lives in the grey world, if you like, where a Bailey's black and white. There's good. There's bad. There's things you do, there's things you don't do. For Ronnie,
there's nothing you don't do.
No, he'll cross any line if it's to support his idea, America's idea of the greater good, which is actually where the idea for the title of my first book came from.
It is, yeah. And he and Bailey help each other out, actually. It's not a one-way street.
Oh, they do, and they're friends.
Yeah.
And they're good friends. But there are lines that Bailey won't cross and doesn't want to cross and has been forced into really difficult situations because of Ronnie, and he's angry.
That.
He's angry.
Yeah, he's not happy.
That.
He's not always happy.
But he also is smart enough to know that people like Ronnie need to exist because of all the bad people out there.
He's not an idealist, Bailey. Mm. I mean, he's a realist, but yeah, he's not. He doesn't. Think he may be an optimist, but he doesn't think that the world is full of fairy dust and, you know, whatever fun stuff. So yeah, that relationship between a writer and his creation, who comes back and back and back, is a really interesting one. And in fact, Tim's going to explore that with some other writers at Bad Sydney. You know, famously Sherlock Holmes had to kill off Moriarty. Conan Doyle had to kill off Sherlock Holmes and then had to bring him back. So you know, can a really popular, long-lived hero be a poisoned chalice? Are you going to want to kill Bailey off, or?
I don't think so.
Semi-suicide, would it?
Well, look, he puts himself in harm's way to do what he thinks is right, but I can't write a book about a dead guy. And I also, I'm really enjoying writing these books, and I'll step away and write, you know, some standalones, which I'm starting to.
Are you going to look at that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really interested in writing other books, and I will. I'm not just going to be writing these. But look, I while he's still talking to me, these will be most of these the books that I'm writing.
And can you see other characters in the books, like Holly, come sort of rise to the top and write about them?
Potentially. I'm writing the book I'm writing at the moment has Holly in it, and you a big character.
You could write about Ronnie, how he came to be how he is. I'd like to know that.
Yeah, I've thought about that.
I don't know whether I really would, but.
No, I've thought about that too. In a way, I thought, what's my Ronnie Johnson book going to be? And it was Killer Trader Spy in a way. But there's definitely...
There's a backstory there.
Yeah. In creating this world, I want to continue it. So I don't just want to have, in the John Bailey thrillers, so to speak, have them just kind of appear and it's just these books. So I am interested in that idea of spinning things off, and because if I write in that idea of everything that's effectively real other than the story itself, then these characters are real to me too. So I might find different ways to play with them.
Yeah, I was actually going to talk about a world. That's what you've created, with lots of different aspects and going back into the future, going back to the past, and maybe kind of you can see what the future might be. But the other thing that these books are about is Sydney. And I don't know about you, but I love reading books about where I live. I mean, I lived in London for a long time. There's loads of crime books about set in London and many other places. And, of course, there was Peter Corris, but there's just not been a lot about Sydney for a while.
No, Peter Corris did a great job at it. And, in fact, when I had written the first book, I reached out. He was still alive, and I reached out to try to meet him. I wanted to sort of pick his brain, just talk about writing. And he was unwell, and he ended up dying. It was about 6 or 12 months later. So I never got to catch up, but we had a nice exchange on email. And he said to me that he wrote in 2 one-hour blocks each day, each with a glass of white wine. He said, each with a large glass of
wine. A large glass of
white
wine.
And I just love that he shared that with me, and because I was always interested. And when I hear things like that from other writers, it takes the pressure off a bit as well, because I know there are so many different ways of working. And I remember, so Bryce Courtney used to write for 7 months of the year, 6 days a week, for 10 hours or 10 or 12 hours a day. 10 hours a day. So he'd
do
that.
Not much life left.
I think it was 12 actually, yeah. So he'd do that for 7 months of the year. And then the other 5 months, he would be promoting.
His whole life was his writing.
That's it. He was a storyteller, and that's what he was doing. But then, you know, there are other writers where they might write intensively for a few weeks to just push something and get it down. I've got a mate who's a writer who's got a caravan down the coast, and he will write about 50,000 words in like 2 weeks or something, just to get it down. It's James Phelps.
Oh, okay.
And he's a true crime writer. He's written a lot of great.
He's written a novel
books.
As well.
Yeah, he's written a novel as well. Like Inside that. Man, it's a good book. But he's also the prison books. I don't know if you've seen those. He's written a lot of those, and they're profiles of Australian's prisons. Mm. So yeah, but he writes like that. But why I was saying it's quite nice to hear that from Peter Corris is because some days I used to think when I have writing time, I need to be writing because I was so time poor.
Because you had no time, yeah.
Yeah, so it was Saturday and Sunday. And then now that I've left the ABC, I'm just writing full time, I sit down and go, I've got to be writing. But I don't actually. I need to be thinking, plotting, planning, researching, and it's a whole different way of working. So some days I might only write for 2 or 3 hours, but maybe I've had another 4 hours of sort of research or gone walking the dogs and trying to think through something. And
do you think that'll make a difference to what you write, how you write? Because it's an interesting thing. When you change your life, you're not writing in the holes between everything else. You can do it whenever.
Well, look, thinking time is really important. And also reading is as well. And I try to I'm always reading other novels. I read a bit of non-fiction as well, to be honest, but I don't like reading novels that I'm not really into or that I have to read sometimes because I worry that it takes my focus away or from my writing. But if I'm reading, for instance, so I love Michael Connelly's books. In many ways, I actually only discovered him, it's crazy, but I only discovered him after I'd written my first book. So I was very late to the party. So that's 2000 and I reckon 19. I read his first, 2018, I read the first Michael Connelly, the poet, because my publisher said, you remind me of early Connelly. So I went, oh, I better check
Michael
out.
Connelly writes LA, if you've read any of his books. Yeah. He's a fabulous...
I'm sure.
I've never been to LA, but I have a sense from... Yeah. Of the complexity as well.
Well, and yeah, I mean, mentioning him, because what he's done for LA with the Harry Bosch character, I'm trying to do for Sydney with John Bailey. And the fact that I kind of got there myself before I started reading him makes me feel like good because
yeah,
I'm not trying to rip him off.
You're doing what you're doing.
But I can I can happily read a Connolly book while I'm writing. I usually only read one of his a year, the new one that comes out, or maybe two a year probably. But
bit of backlist to catch up on probably.
Yeah, there is, yeah. But reading his books... Mm. His books are so good and so well plotted and the writing's tight and the characters are great that I'm almost inspired by it, if you know what I mean. So I'm never nicking ideas or anything from him, but I'm inspired by it because that's the level. You know, that's the level that I need to be at if I'm going to be a good writer. And I think, okay, Connolly's got it. And
you make Sydney... So what's great as well is that things come up, new things happen in the city. There's new tunnels, for example.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people might get lost in those new tunnels or might take the wrong turning or end up where they don't want to be.
$30 later, you're popping out at the wrong place.
Yeah, and you think, how the hell do I get back? And my favourite one was in your last book, I think, and I've probably said this last year, but it's the squinters. So if you haven't read the book, you should read it, but squinters are people who live in the inner west and they're called squinters because they squint on the way to work if they're driving because they're going into the sun and they squint on the way home because they're going... home and the sun's in the opposite direction. I loved that.
I didn't coin the phrase, but
no. I just thought it was lovely. I can't get over it really. Maybe it's I'm childish, but
yeah. But look, Sydney is a character in all my books.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sydney, and as I said before, and this is in many ways describes Bailey's view of it, but mine as well. I love the place. I hate the place. There's nowhere else I'd rather be because it's a character. Like it is a. It's not only a global city, but it's interesting. You know, there's extreme wealth here, particularly by the water. And then once you get into
the Palm Beach descriptions. And you do it well because it's not, it's kind of factual, but it's not, geez, how could these people have so much money? I mean, you know, we can make up our own minds if we happen to have a house in Palm Beach, good for us.
But a lot of it's inherited wealth. Yeah. And then if you look at where all the new migrants go, because they don't have inherited wealth.
They're not going to go to
Palm
Beach.
So they're all in the west and the southwest of Sydney. So you've got northern beaches, eastern suburbs, North Shore.
And then everything
the demographics
else.
Are slowly changing a bit, but predominantly very, very white.
Mm.
And then if you're going into the western suburbs or, you know, you go to a multicultural melting pot like, Fairfield, and you've got this really interesting, like, new Australian communities. That's part of the reason Australia's, Sydney's so interesting for me because out of all of that, you have issues like inequality, racism, You have, like, you know, the new cultures coming to Australia and into Sydney and teaching people things they didn't know, or opening their eyes to things they didn't know.
And it's not just restaurants,
giving them
which
new
is
experience.
Really annoying.
But often through food.
Yeah.
And that's great.
But not only. I mean, it's also about...
No, of course not.
So I've been... So just slight sidetracked him. At BAD this year, we're presenting a book, a new book of short stories written by writers from Western Sydney, from Westwards in Western Sydney. And I've just been, it's microfiction and short stories, and so we put out a call, Westwards did, and I've been reading them. And it was actually, I've led a sheltered life, not that sheltered, I haven't lived, in a cupboard for most of my life, but it was extraordinary to read the daily reality in a short story of other people's lives. Like, they just plunged you straight into it. And I came out going to the guy I was judging with, this is just revealing, revelatory. So I really encourage you to come to that, by the way. It's called Bad Western Sydney, The Second Case. But it's very much about that different Sydney that we don't see. And you do talk about lots of different kinds of city.
I do. I try to paint a true picture of the place. And Sydney's a character. And then, yes, I write about, joking and spending your life in tunnels if you're not careful and missing the beauty and everything in the place. It's always a character for me.
Yeah,
it's really important.
And that's a real richness. Apart from the story, it's that what it gives you. I think it's fine if you don't know Sydney, but it's also great if you do. You just get an extra layer. You mentioned talking about misogyny, and one of the things I was going to ask you is: you're a man, you write women. Is it more difficult to write women? Is it more difficult to write men? How do you deal with that? What are the challenges?
Look, strong characters, interesting characters share a lot of the same attributes to be the people that I'm trying to write that they are. But I do draw on some of those people that have either inspired me or really strong, like, women in my life, whether it's my bosses, at the ABC or other places that I've worked, my wife, my daughter, friends, that I've so many of the stories that they've had around experiences with misogyny, are things that I've really been attuned to and listening to, and it's helped me with the book, and particularly my wife as well. I grew up with a very sort of traditional family life with three brothers, and I went to an all-boys boarding school. So I think I learned to talk to women when I was about 30. My wife inspires me every day, and she's tough and so it's making sure I've got those people in my life that actually then helps me, write those.
And there is a lot of, or there has been, a lot of kickback, I suppose, about writing characters whose lives you haven't experienced. But unless you can't write fiction unless you do.
I don't buy that stuff, to be honest with you. I find it troubling that the arts community now is some people within it are saying, no, you can't include that in your creation, or the piece of art or the work you're writing, because of your ethnicity or your experience.
Or your gender.
I actually think that you've just got to do a good job at it. It's like journalism. For me, you've got to do your research. And if you are going to take on, some subjects that are a bit more sensitive, make sure that you've got potentially people who have had that experience feeding back on your work, giving you or spending time with them to make sure you get it right.
Doing your research, right?
So it's doing your research. But I think it's a dangerous place that we go to if we say you can no longer tell stories that aren't directly related to your own experience.
Yeah, well, there wouldn't be much interesting writing, frankly, would there? So if you've got any questions, start to think about them. Well, I've left a few minutes, but I'd like to ask about the book title. So you've told us about The Greater Good.
Yep.
What about the others?
Well, I always think of a big picture title in a way that talks to what the book's about. So I mentioned The Greater Good before. So State of Fear is that, you know, terrorism was the drumbeat of our daily lives for well over a decade from what happened in the Lindt Cafe to attacks in London and, you know, all over the world. And so that idea that we were all made to feel fearful was something that I wrote about in that book, but also in some ways, you know, parodied as well, because the world actually had never been safer than at that time. The world is never safer, you know, in terms of if you think about walking the streets and all of that, like we are actually very, very, very fortunate. But through media scare campaigns and shock jocks and those trying to twist stories of life into selling their own, you know, misguided message, they have helped create a state of fear. So that's sort of when I think about a big picture title, that's an example of that, and I try to explore the issue in all different ways. And then I think of The Enemy Within, which is the third book. I write about abuse of power. So when I was working at the ABC, the Australian Federal Police came into the ABC and they had a warrant. They were looking for the source of a story that the couple of great ABC journalists had done about alleged human rights abuses by Australian soldiers in Afghanistan. And that warrant they used that day gave them the power to alter, change, copy or delete the ABC's files in the course of their investigation. And that warrant was signed off by a district court judge. And I thought, what? I mean, that power could be easily abused.
I didn't realise it was a district court judge. Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, some the
yeah,
top.
It's just got to be in the jurisdiction. So, in the state. So that The Enemy Within was about, okay, what if that power went into the wrong hands? And then also that idea of with far-right nationalism and then white supremacists being the extreme end of that, that where are these people and they're in and around, you know, in us. So they're, you know, the idea of The Enemy Within. And then Killer, Traitor, Spy, well, it's a spy novel. It's a bit of a nod to Le Carre in a way. I think trying to come up with a title and thought it's about a killer. There's a traitor in there and it's about spies. So, yeah.
So it's pretty self-explanatory.
And look, and The Wrong Man is... So, yes, there's this very basic idea of the wrong man being in prison for a crime, but it's actually bigger than that.
Yeah.
It's about... Because this is a book that explores misogyny in all those levels, it's about the wrong kind of man.
Yeah.
And that's really what the overarching...
There are a lot of wrong men.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of wrong men. Any questions, anybody? Either shout and I'll repeat it or there are mics coming.
Yeah. Yeah, I think... this question is just for the recording is around censorship and whether we... whether it's potentially going to be an on-running issue. I think we're going to have a conversation about it for quite a long time. It's thinking for... Look, I think that some... I wouldn't say there's some censorship. There's got to be sensitivity rather than censorship. So I think about... As an example of that would be David Baldacci's latest book, A Calamity of Souls, is a really, really... good novel, probably his best in my view. I haven't read a lot, but from what I've read of his, it's a big picture book about set just in, around the Civil Rights Act and in America and the issue around obviously racism in the courts and people being falsely accused. It's a good novel, but why I raise it is he doesn't spell out the N-word in that book. He just has N with a dash, and that's powerful, and it worked. Whereas probably 10, 15 years ago, you would have used the word in the book. I don't know. I don't think that's censorship. I think that's sensitivity, and I think for someone like Baldacci, he's looking at the size of his audience. I mean, he's sold, I'd stagger to think, it's over 100 million books. He's got a very big audience, so he's bringing people, a lot of other people who may not know a lot about that issue, He's bringing that through popular fiction, and I think that's really powerful.
He's telling them something.
He is, yeah.
By the dashes, really.
Yep.
Yeah. Anything else apart from censorship? Well, we've got a couple of minutes left. Tell me about the names. How did Bailey get called John Bailey? It's a very middle of the road name.
I don't know. It just popped in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was writing the first page of the book. So when I started writing The Greater Good, it wasn't called The Greater Good. It was called something else. I actually renamed it well after I'd written the book because of the way I'd ended it. And I went, actually, this book, I want something that captures the whole thing. That's where it came up. But so I had started a new job. I was the national editor of 7 O'Clock News. It's back in 2013. And I'd just been at this job for almost a year and working crazy hours, and it was really 7 days a week, and I'd never had lunch breaks or anything, and we'd always just eat at our desk and just keep going. Being at 8:30, I'd leave at 7:30 when the news was finished, and so I went, no, bugger this, I need some time myself, and I went and sat around the corner in this little sushi place around the corner from the ABC, and I took my iPad with me. And I was just going to read some stuff. And I just sat there and I opened the notes section and I just started writing the book. And I sat there for about 45 minutes while I was eating, and I wrote the first page of The Greater Good. And that first page, so I ended up putting a prologue at the beginning later, but the first page of chapter one is pretty much identical to what I did in that cafe that day. And in that page, I came up with the character of John Bailey, named him, came up with the crime, the fact that the woman he'd walked out on, Sharon Dexter, was the cop on the scene of the crime, the fact that he was a war correspondent who didn't want to have to go and cover shitty crime stories.
I think it's just as well you took that lunchtime.
It just all came, like I'd been thinking about it for a while, and I just suddenly went, okay, I'm just going to see what this looks like. And it was almost like throwing paint on a canvas and it stuck.
Well, I think we should all be very pleased about that. I just want to tell you that several things, actually. The first thing is that Tim's book, Killer, Traitor, Spy, I shouldn't really be saying this, but anyway, I will, is one of the books on the shortlist for the Danger Awards of Best Crime Fiction. And, absolutely, and that means automatically it goes into the People's Choice Award, which we also have, that Libby app, the library app, sponsor us. So from Monday, you'll be able to vote. So you just go to the BAD website, BAD Sydney, and you'll find a button saying vote here. So you can do that. The other thing is you can actually hear Tim talking. Yeah, he will talk to some degree about the book, but interviewing other writers. So the world of spies. You tell us who you're interviewing on Saturday, the 14th of September.
Yeah, so there's a guy called Jack Beaumont. He was a French spy. He wrote The Frenchman, and his latest book's called Dark Arena. That's a pseudonym, by the way, he writes by, because he was in the DGSE, which is the equivalent to the CIA. And he was in there for a long time, and he's a fascinating guy.
Some of his stories.
Yeah. And Matt Bevan, who many of you may know from If You're Listening, Russia If You're Listening, those podcasts from the ABC. He's done a lot of deep dive research in the spy game around the world and how it all works. I've just forgotten his name.
Nick Stride.
So Nick Stride is a fascinating character. He worked for a former Russian prime minister, and he effectively got to the point where he felt he knew too much, and he was worried about him and his family. He was in Russia and he managed to get out, and he's now living in New Zealand in hiding, effectively. And his book came out last year, and it's fascinating. So we've got, you know, many different times. Yeah, there's been stories in the newspaper about him as well. But anyway, that chat is going to be fascinating.
That's going to be fabulous. Another one is thinking about, we're talking about Sydney. A lot of Australian writers set their books overseas, America, England and other places. So you're interviewing Candice Fox, who started here but now sets a lot of her books in America, Michael Robotham, all of whose books have been in America, well, mostly in England, but there's a couple in America. Michael Brissenden, who's another ABC journo, whose books, first two books were here, he's gone to America. And Roger Simpson, ditto, he's just gone off to America. So what the hell is going on? So you're going to tease that out a bit. And then you'll be on the other side of the mic talking about what we were talking about earlier, favourite detectives, favourite characters who come back and back and back. And Kate Evans from Radio National, who does The Bookshelf, if you've ever heard her, she's a fabulous interviewer and loves crime, which is really good. I mean, as in crime fiction. She's going to tease that out a bit and look at, you know, will you ever get fed up? What are the problems? What about the fact that they've got blue shoes in book two and brown shoes in book three and all that kind of thing. So I recommend that. And, of course, Abby's is outside. You can buy the books. And it occurred to me recently that it's Father's Day quite soon. I must have seen an ad. And these books are great to read for men and women, which is not always the case. Some books, people think, oh, they're just for women. But these books can be read by anybody and really enjoyed and have fabulous characters. And the City of Sydney, what could be better? Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks to you all for coming along. It's been a lot of fun, and to the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts for having us.
A huge thank you to Tim and Catherine for sharing such a great conversation. I'd also like to thank our amazing event audience and for you for listening. The SMSA members can borrow all five of the John Bailey series books from our library, including The Wrong Man. The Wrong Man is also available at your local bookstore for sale, and we've left a link to our friends at Abbey's in the accompanying text. It was fantastic to get the scoop from Catherine regarding this year's Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival. We've also provided links to their website so you can check out their newly released programs. So I'd just like to say a huge thank you for listening, and let's catch up again soon.